Howdy, I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedar.
And we are back again with the second half of The Adventure of the Red Circle. And why did this have two parts?
This is the Empire Strikes Back version, Steve.
Is it really, Chip? Is this the best Doyle can do? Is that what you're saying?
No.
Well, it is a bit surprising that this was in two parts. The opening of part two just picks up seconds after part one. If there was no chapter break there, I don't think we would have even noticed. But there was a chapter break. And when we pick it up, basically, Watson just continues to narrate. As we walked rapidly down Howe Street, I glanced back at the building which we had left. There, dimly outlined at the top window, I could see the shadow of a head, a woman's head, gazing tensely, rigidly out into the night, waiting with breathless suspense for the renewal of that interrupted message. Exactly as we left them, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I thought it was super interesting. So when they get over, they run out to see what's going on. They get over to the Howe Street flat, and who is standing there right in front of the flat but Inspector Gregson? Now, what happens then I thought was very surprising. "Why, Gregson," said my companion as he shook hands with the Scotland Yard detective. "Journey's end with lovers meeting. What brings you here?" Did you guys pause at that moment?
This seems very out of character for Holmes. He certainly likes Gregson. He definitely likes him more than he likes Lestrade. But what a strange thing to say, Mr. Holmes.
What brings you out on this journey this evening?
Well, and it's interesting because "Journey's End with Lovers' Meetings" is a very famous quote from Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. And it's a carpe diem kind of moment where it's, you know, lovers like, let's move forward with our relationship. And it's often read as meaning like two lovers form a whole, creating an end to their journey. So it's a bit of an odd statement for Sherlock and Gregson.
It seems completely inappropriate. It seems like, what are you trying to say here, Doyle? What does this mean? We understand its meaning from Twelfth Night. Why is it here?
And the reason I really recognized it like so easily, because I'm no Shakespeare scholar, let me tell you, is that I recently read Shirley Jackson's wonderful Gothic novel, The Haunting of Hill House. And in that novel, that quotation is a kind of mantra throughout the whole novel. And, you know, this woman really is seeking something. And so I actually talked to my friend Lynn Tribble, the Shakespearean, yesterday and was like, all right, she's a Shakespearean. She's a big Sherlock fan. I was like, what's happening here? And she said, oh, in the 19th century, you get people quoting Shakespeare totally out of context and with no discernible meaning. All the time. It's a 19th century thing. I was like, well, okay.
I guess borrowing from the master is something that you do as a writer. If this worked in that context and it has a little bit of shorthand to it, you use it. But the shorthand doesn't seem to apply to this particular meeting.
It certainly does not.
So we've got lots of other tropes that Doyle is certainly fond of. The tangled skein is mentioned three times in this part of the story.
Well, it's available at your local bookstore, Steve.
But they changed the title. It's called A Study in Scarlet. But yes, he loves this analogy of the web and the straightening out this tangle of threads. He just loves it.
Available at all booksellers. Let me go ahead and throw this little advertisement right here.
This tangled skein is especially interesting because we have not only two detective sets, you know, Sherlock and Watson on one side as consulting detectives, and then Gregson, Lestrade, whoever else from Scotland Yard. We have a third detective. And this is actually one of the later stories. We got a lot of mutual admiration between the different detective forces. Did you guys notice that?
They had secret handshakes, high fives. Right.
Talking about being lovers, you know, whatever.
So Holmes says that it seems that Gregson has things well under control. "Wait a bit," cried Gregson eagerly. "I'll do you this justice, Mr. Holmes, that I was never in a case yet that I didn't feel stronger for having you on my side. Now that's very different from the earlier relationships, right, between Scotland Yard and Holmes. And then a little bit later, Gregson says, Mr. Holmes talks of signals. I expect as usual, he knows a good deal that we don't, which is totally true, of course. And then Gregson has someone exciting to introduce. Did you guys get excited here?
I got excited for you. I knew that you would be excited when we got to the word Pinkerton. A Pinkerton detective is on the case.
Well, I was going to throw this out there. It was when we did the pre-show that the connection, and I was like, oh, I didn't catch that. I didn't catch that. So.
Really?
Listen, the word Pinkerton? I'm just a guy. I'm just a guy.
You're just along for the ride. We're all just in Pam's wake here. And and we appreciate the joy that she gets in this. And yes, I thought of you so much when the introduction of Mr. Leverton, a Pinkerton's American agent, is here on the case.
He's the hero of the Long Island cave mystery, said Holmes. And when I was reading this aloud to my daughters last night, they were like, Long Island, we can see it right across the Long Island Sound. I'm like, that's right. There was a cave mystery there and Pinkertons in the 19th century. So Holmes says, I'm pleased to meet you. The American, a quiet, businesslike young man with a clean-shaven hatchet face, flushed up at the words of commendation. So obviously they're familiar with one another's reputations, right? Now, in the Pinkerton Agency in the U.S., which starts in the 1860s, is a private detective force. Now, we're going to get, if we keep going with this thing and we get to the Valley of Fear, the very last of the Sherlock novels, we'll get into the Pinkertons in much more detail. But the Pinkertons are a very morally dubious, right? They do surveillance. They do surveillance in the workplace. They, like, you could hire them to spy on your employees to make sure they're doing what you need them to do. They do strike breaking. So they're kind of the man against, you know, workers' rights. And they have a really interesting relationship with the official police force. So all the things that are interesting in Holmes, but from the American perspective. That's all I'll say about the Pinkertons. But there's a Pinkerton in this story.
So the seeds have been planted that we will revisit this later.
Mm. Yes.
Gregson says that they don't need a warrant for their entry into this home.
What type of world is this?
Right? And so, yeah, because Gregson and Leverton have followed this guy. So they're coming from, so Watson and Holmes, they're following the signal. Gregson and Leverton are following a criminal, a murderer, and they're not sure if they can go in the house or not. And Gregson says, don't worry about it. Watson says, our official detectives may blunder in the matter of intelligence, but never in that of courage.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite lines from this part. That this is Watson really admiring the courage of Scotland Yard detectives.
They might not be that strong, but they're brave.
Well, and then they, I think they justify this ability to go in without a warrant in this area too.
It's an unoccupied building that they are in possibly illegally. So they have a reason to enter this building to get this guy, which makes a little bit of sense. It's pretty sketchy to not have a warrant to arrest somebody, though.
And then it's interesting, as Watson's describing them go up, Gregson climbed the stair to arrest this desperate murderer with the same absolutely quiet and businesslike bearing with which he would have ascended the official staircase of Scotland Yard. So he's completely confident. The Pinkerton man had tried to push past him, but Gregson had firmly elbowed him back. London dangers were the privilege of the London force.
We see this so often in murder mysteries. If the federal police come into an investigation, it is offensive to the local police. And here the American, of course, is trying to barge his way into this case, and Gregson won't allow that. This is good writing here.
It's almost comical when they get to the top of the stairs. Gregson flung open the door and held his light full blaze in front of him, while we all peered eagerly over his shoulders. There's like way too many people in this scene trying to look over Gregson's tall shoulders. And the...
That is cinematic. That is cinematic imagery. I had that in my head. Well, like, yeah. Here's Gregson strong walking into the door, and then there's their one head, and then there's the other head. What's going on?
And of course, what they find is nothing less than a body.
Dun, dun, dun.
Right? The description is interesting. In the middle of the floor of the empty room was huddled the figure of an enormous man, his clean-shaven, swarthy face grotesquely horrible in its contortion, and his head encircled by a ghastly crimson halo of blood, lying in a broad, wet circle upon the white woodwork. Giant as he was, the man must have gone down like a pole-axed ox before that terrific blow. And oh my goodness, a pole-axed ox? Okay, first of all, don't say that three times fast. But that sounds like an American Dime novel, right? This doesn't sound like Doyle.
Huh, I'm wondering if he is reading some Dime novels to, you know, just kind of see what the young people are writing at the day. And
throwing a little Shakespeare in, too? Gee, I wonder what Doyle's trying to do here.
He's a literary man. He goes highbrow and lowbrow. But, you know, it's important that if you're going to be killed that day, just go ahead and shave, you know? He's clean shaven.
He is clean shaven. There is that. But back to that swarthy face again. This is Doyle with his tropes, his favorite things to say. This is not an Englishman. This is a foreigner. And back to that grotesquely horrible contortion again. Yes.
If it bleeds, it leads, right? This is very much of the newspapers of that time.
This is the scandal sheets that Sherlock Holmes is so famously in love with, the idea of knowing the grotesque details. Here's Doyle showing us how it's done.
And so it's really interesting because we briefly went into that sort of sensational mode, but then we're right back with Holmes, as he always is. He actually gives a description of the man they're looking for. And he's over at the window in the meantime, like playing with the candle. And Gregson sort of complains that the description isn't that much to go on with like millions of people in London. And Holmes says, perhaps not. That is why I thought it best to summon the lady to your aid. And basically, just like moments later, this young girl like pops in the door. Oh, hi. And she's the person they're looking for. And so Holmes loves that. This is the magician trick again, right? Well, he was over at the window. He was signaling to the girl, hey, come on over. I'm ready for you.
And I completely missed that. I completely missed the Sherlock Holmes is at the window with the candle, sending a message to the young lady. I completely skipped it. And so did Gregson. And so did the Pinkerton detective, because they didn't pay any attention to Sherlock.
Exactly.
So I missed so much, but I totally caught that. I knew exactly what he was doing.
That is so funny, because guys, how many times have we seen Holmes do this, right? Please have a seat. The murderer is about to come in and visit us. Like, he does it all the time. And so, so this is another one of those super satisfying British detective moments that's very much in contrast. Like, you know that the American Dime novel detective, the Pinkerton, he's not going to be summoning people with candles as he's telling you the, you know, shoe size of the murderer. Like, that's a Holmes thing.
That is very Holmes. And then we get the complete opposite character walking in. The young lady who was the lodger across the street comes running in. She is overjoyed at the death of her captor. Yeah. She says, "You have killed him," she muttered. "Oh, Dio mio, you have killed him." Then I heard a sudden sharp intake of her breath, and she sprang into the air with a cry of joy. Round and round the room she danced, her hands clapping, her dark eyes gleaming with delighted wonder, and a thousand pretty Italian exclamations pouring from her lips. It was terrible and amazing to see such a woman so convulsed with joy at such a sight.
So, Steve, why did you not do that in an Italian accent? Come on, man.
It's me, the lodger from across the street. That's offensive.
And that's why you didn't do it in an Italian accent.
I was trying to think of like the actress who has an Italian accent. You know, I can't think of one. But they certainly
Brigida.
Yeah, there you go. She comes in and she goes, "Oh," and it's just like it all happens right there.
This is again very cinematic. I see this scene happening. But did you think that she was going to be upset at the death of the man at the beginning when she says, "You have killed him. Oh, Dio mio, you have killed him." Did you think that this was somebody that she didn't want dead at first?
I was just drinking it in, Steve. I wasn't really thinking about that. I don't know. I kind of am on the train ride. As it reveals itself, I'm taking it in.
Okay. I thought she was angry with the idea of this man being killed until Doyle changes it up on us and starts with the cry of joy and the round and round the room she danced, hands clapping. This was good writing, Doyle. Good job.
I'm with you, Steve. I think he wanted us to think, oh no, she's going to be super upset. And then she's just in this like all out celebration. So mm-hmm. I thought the same.
The summoning is explained for me because I didn't catch it. Holmes went to the window and spelled out Vini, which means come with the light. And she came running across the street as fast as she could. Amazingly quick. There it is. Found it.
And then she explains the whole story of Giuseppe Gorgiano, the dead man. She explains that she and her husband, the substitute lodger, were Italians who emigrated to New York City. There they met a countryman. And one day Gennaro brought Gorgiano, thanks for the such similar names, brought him home. And he was an enormous blustering man who was raving about politics.
I love this quote. She says, "There was scarce room for the whirl of his great arms as he talked." Oh, Doyle, that is stereotyping. There's definitely a stereotype about Italians. I think Chip mentioned that stereotype yesterday, as a matter of fact.
Oh my goodness. Well, you know, it's good to go down to the Italian town in your local city and use those types of terms and watch see the love in their face as you
stereotypes come from somewhere, but it's still not okay at this point. That's pretty cringy. This enormous Doyle keeps telling us how big this guy was. And to have him in their tiny little house and just taking up all the space, both verbally, his voice is large, and bodily. That's some good imagery.
It is. And then Emilia tells us she eventually realizes that her husband is afraid of Gorgiano. And it turns out that the two of them were members of a secret society in Italy, the Red Circle, which is where we're getting the title of this story. And so Gennaro gets a summons, which is a red circle, to go to the lodge. And Gorgiano, it turns out, goes by the name Death. And I like this quote, "For he was red to the elbow in murder." And that's an American Dime novel kind of quote.
Not just his hands, but all the way up to the elbow. I love that line.
Oh my goodness.
And of course, one day Gorgiano actually sexually assaults Emilia. So we have that sense again that people like Holmes and Watson, I mean, they will obviously not put up with murder, but also they're very much like the assault of women is not acceptable. Like this puts things into a different place in terms of justice.
This has got to be very topical at the time because Doyle mentions this so often in his stories. And if you recognize that this is aimed at the, you know, average British family, the average American family, this idea of this is certainly an incorrect way or working with, you know, women in society.
Mm-hmm. This is something that Doyle comes back to so often that, yes, this is very much on the minds of people who are reading these stories at this time.
Mm-hmm. And I just would say that, you know, in the Victorian period and in other periods, there have been some women who were much more protected than others, right? So middle and upper class white women were quite protected against sexual assault compared to working class women mm-hmm. and women of color. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's still a complicated issue in 2020 and it has been for centuries, mm-hmm. but I always find it interesting how much Doyle you know, that was like a one paragraph unnecessary detail, but he does pull it in. And I think it does serve to create Gorgiano as an even more vile character than the blood to the elbows, mm-hmm. right? So there's a lot to consider in terms of how Doyle represents, I think rather progressively, the question of policing sexual behavior.
He's a modern man in a modern world.
In some ways. Now, it turns out the Red Circle Society targets Gennaro's benefactor and says, someone's going to have to murder this guy. Gennaro's like friend and almost father figure. And of course, Gennaro draws the Red Circle, which means he's the one who's supposed to commit the murder.
Can we go ahead and say that this character is going to be played by Joe Pesci?
Yes, exactly. Yes. And, you know, secret societies are like a really interesting topic in the 19th century. And as I'm thinking ahead, you know, the Valley of Fear is all about a secret society. So anyway, this is something that obviously interests Doyle a lot. Mm-hmm. Then Emilia and Gennaro flee to England. And now, finally, Gennaro has succeeded in killing the large and horrible Gorgiano. And we end with questions of justice, as we often have in these stories, right? When Emilia finishes her recital of facts, she says, "And now, gentlemen, I would ask you whether we have anything to fear from the law, or whether any judge upon earth would condemn my Gennaro for what he has done."
This is a topic that we've come across so many times in these stories. Doyle recognizes that sometimes he leaves the law out of his stories. And here we have two detectives and a consulting detective and Dr. Watson tagging along. And so we can't just let him go. We have to talk about, you know, the law as it relates to justice here.
And it's interesting because the Pinkerton speaks up. "Well, Mr. Gregson," said the American, looking across at the official, "I don't know what your British point of view may be, but I guess that in New York, this lady's husband will receive a pretty general vote of thanks." And that's totally the American perspective, right?
Of course, the uncivilized Americans here. Yeah.
Right? Well, they had a bad guy and they wanted to capture him, dead or alive, you know, that old trope, and they've captured him.
I guess it would, based on what you just said there, it would fall under a person being an outlaw, outside the law, right. Thus does not have the rights of a law-abiding citizen.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And interestingly, Gregson agrees. He says, "Well, I am going to have to like take you to Scotland Yard. We'll have to do some official paperwork, but I think you'll be just fine." And then he turns to Holmes and asks him, "So come on, buddy. How did you actually end up here? Like, how did you get to this same place that we did when following Gorgiano?" And so Holmes's response here brings us to the ending of the story. "Education, Gregson, education, still seeking knowledge at the old university. Well, Watson, you have one more specimen of the tragic and grotesque to add to your collection. By the way, it is not 8 o'clock and a Wagner night at Covent Garden. If we hurry, we might be in time for the second act." The end. And so when I was reading this to my daughters, they were like, "Ooh, they're going to go on a date."
Well, so 2020, right?
They're having this discussion over the corpse of this guy, and they go, "Oh, let's go out to the theater."
Do they know what Wagner will have as far as a connection to a really heinous area at the time in the world history, right?
Well, very good point. But notice that ending. So that four lines in the story, but he says, "Oh, I'm always learning." He's like, "I was here for my education." He hadn't really thought this was an particularly interesting case when Mrs. Warren was like, "Please, please, please help me with my lodger." And so, but he's always learning. And so he says, "Yeah, I was out here for education." Then he says, "And Watson, so I learned something. Watson, you got another story, right? One more specimen of the tragic and grotesque. And let's go get some art." So we've got, I mean, really, right?
Over a nice bottle of wine, maybe.
Right? So we have education, narrative, and art. It's the perfect ending. I love it.
Okay. He is a well-rounded human there. That
right?
All right. So you love the ending. I got that. Is this going to be one of your favorites when we do the wrap-up of his last bow?
See what else is to come, my friends. I don't like to choose so early in the set.
I got to say, I did not love this story. The info dump at the end just did it for me. It's like, yep, here's all everything.
That's the whole second half of the story. It's like, and we got this big buildup of, like, why is this even, why would Sherlock Holmes even take this case? In the second half, you're like, and now we're just going to dump all this information to you.
Yep. I don't like that.
And at the end, they're off to the theater.
Your favorite story. Right?
So hopefully everybody out there is listening and paying attention and enjoying these stories as much as we are, even when there's one that you don't like as much. We'll get to another one tomorrow. Maybe tomorrow's will be just our favorite of the whole collection. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text or send us an email. We would love to hear the sound of your voice. Make sure you're following our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of that information from around the world, and go to our dedicated website, sandwichesandirregularhours.com, to see all of these conversations that we've collected. Boy, there's so many of them. There's so many conversations at this point. We've got lots ahead of us, so stick with us. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Essenflo.
And I'm Cam Vidor.
Where's my sandwich?
Moral of this one is death, then theater.
Ooh, I like that.